Welcome, everybody. This is the 13th and last lecture in our course on Perspectives on Bhikkhuni Ordination, held by the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative and the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg. And today, before leaving room to our lecture, I just wanted to express my gratitude, first of all, to the members of the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative, that is Lisa Fancott, Petra Kiefer-Pilz, and Kamala Shetsumo, who will be talking today, for the support. To all of the lecturers who have so generously given their time and dedication, and some of them even been very intensely helping with the discussion in the discussion forum. To all the students and colleagues for participating, coming to the lecture, and also for the very interesting discussions we had. And perhaps most importantly, I would like to express my gratitude to the e-learning department of the University of Hamburg, without whose technical assistance it has been impossible for us to do this course. And I'm very happy to have here in our virtual classroom with us Janina Reimers. Can you show yourself to us, please? She is a student of Unlisted, and she has been particularly tutoring and sustaining in this course, because my own technical abilities are very limited. Fortunately, she is much better in this than me. Janina, can you show yourself to us?
Actually, I can't, because today on the last day, my webcam doesn't work, and I don't seem to be able to fix that. I'm really sorry about that. But in the name of the whole e-learning department, I would also like to say thank you for this great course and for everything we experienced with you. We had a lot of fun, and it was a great semester for us as well.
Oh, lovely. Well, thank you very much, and too bad we couldn't show you to the others, but at least you were present and said a few words, so that was beautiful. So now I move off, but before I hand over to Venerable Shetsumo, I just wanted to announce that we are planning a similar course for next year in the summer semester, 2015, and I hope you will all be interested in joining us again, and I also hope that Janina will be there again trying to help me. And the topic that we have in mind will be women in Buddhism. So this broadens out a little bit from this very specific focus we had on bhikkhuni ordination in this course to the general situation of women in Indian Buddhism. And we are present in the course of contacting several lecturers to see if they are willing to present. And so I would invite all of you to check the website of the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies, the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative, first thing around second half of February, because that will be the registration period again. And as you know, it's necessary to register for the course ahead. So that's all for now, and it's my pleasure now to hand over to Venerable Shetsumo. I don't need to introduce her, because you all have already met her 2 weeks ago when she gave a lecture on Chalamedikas in the Himalayas. So yeah, I'm off, and now we are with Bhikkhuni ordinations across cultures.
Can you hear me?
Well, I can't hear you, so I'll just hope that you can hear me. I'm very happy to be with you here.
We cannot see you.
We cannot see you,
right? We can hear you, but we cannot see you. Yeah.
Okay, good. They've gone to try to find a microphone. I'm here in a monastery in central Taiwan called Nanlin Buddhist Institute, and we have about 60 bhikshunis here in this marvelous monastery, all of them well-educated, well-trained, and very interested in Vinaya. This particular monastery is famous for Vinaya practice. So I actually tried my lecture out on them this afternoon and it was really interesting to see their feedback. They're trying to see, can you hear me? Okay. It's okay?
Yes.
They're trying to, a microphone. Let's see if this is going to work. Okay, meanwhile, I'd like to start by just giving an overview of Buddhist women's history across cultures. We have the image of Mahamaya giving birth to the prince, Siddhartha, who becomes the future Buddha. Now, I'm going to use some feminist analysis here in this last segment to look at representations of women in the Buddhist tradition. Can you hear me better with this? Can you hear me at all? Perfect sound. Oh, great. Okay, then I'm going to use this mic. Oh, thanks to the nuns for rounding that up. Okay, so we see here that in this image of Mahamaya, she's giving the birth to the baby of the prince, Siddhartha, not through the usual channels, but through her right side. And the baby comes out completely uncontaminated by the vaginal fluids or anything messy like that. So this actually goes along with the myth shown other of the conception of the prince through some sort of immaculate conception, I suppose we could say. It seems Mother Maya's image as of being perfectly pure, perfectly worthy of giving birth to a future Buddha. So here again, we see the Buddha not as a baby, as an ordinary baby, but as a full-fledged Buddha already emerging from her right side. Here, Mother Maya is also shown taking care of the young prince as he takes his first steps. Now, he was very precocious and was able to walk already when he was just born and to proclaim his future enlightenment. So, unfortunately, she disappears from the scene 7 days later, and people have pointed out that it seems it's almost as if she served her purpose in giving birth to the baby, and then off she goes. The next image of Yashodhara is of the prince escaping from the palace at night and leaving his wife and newborn son behind with just a glance over his shoulder. Of course, this gave rise to an article titled, Was the Buddha a Deadbeat Dad? But of course, we know that she was not left bereft. She had companions in the palace, she had servants, she had her family, and she was able to manage physically, but we know that she was heartbroken that her husband left her, apparently without a word. We know that because years later, when he returns to visit his father, not his foster mother, apparently, or his wife, or his child, but to visit his father, she at first did not want to see him. She was hiding behind a post, apparently. But eventually, she became his disciple and eventually took ordination as a nun. So the next image of women that appears in the text, prominently at least, is Sujata, called Radha in some texts, the woman who offers rice pudding to the Buddha, who is undergoing these diligent austerities and has gotten so emaciated that he can barely meditate anymore. So she's the one who nourishes him so that he can complete his task of achieving perfect awakening. He takes the rice pudding, he walks across the Niranjana River, sits down under a people tree, and makes a vow not to arise until he achieves perfect awakening. So she was quite pivotal in the Buddha's story. After the Buddha's enlightenment, he gathered many, many disciples, of all different socioeconomic backgrounds, including many women. So we have stories in that of some remarkable women who listen to the teachings, who are moved to practice the teachings, to take up the path, and eventually, well, now, I was interested to hear that there aren't many references to women as arhats in the early texts. That was quite disappointing, because I had been under the impression that there were many. So I hope someone will try to look further in the different renditions of the text to see if we can find. Who says that? This is in an article by, oh, I'll have to get you the reference. I think it's Petra. Petra, are you with us? No. Oh, in this image, well, this image, yes, Mahaprajapati is portrayed as not so much a Tilashin, but I think the image comes from Burma. At least I've seen this image in a temple, in the Burmese temple in Penang. I think that's where I took this photo, actually. So it's not necessarily that she was a Tilashin. She was obviously a Bhikshuni, but here she's shown as a Tilashin. And as are all the many nuns in the background. And here we have an image of Mahaprajapati. So this is rather a remarkable portrait because we find very few images of Mahaprajapati anywhere in any Buddhist country. I looked for many years and finally found images in Vietnam. She is very popular in Vietnam, especially in the nunneries, and there are two various scenarios. This is one, and then there's another where she's shown giving teachings to five disciples. Well, I'm happy to hear that there are numbers of references to female arhats. Then we should have a debate about that. I'm very happy to hear, and I'll give you the reference as soon as I return. I can't do everything at once here, but okay. So Mahaprajapati, of course, was the first Bhikshuni in Buddhist history. The ordination of Buddhist nuns, as we know, began during the Buddha's lifetime over 2,500 years ago. Mahaprajapati was both his foster mother and his aunt. And after some initial hesitation, the Buddha affirmed that women had equal potential to purify their minds and to achieve the fruits of the path. So this affirmation signals the beginning of the order of Buddhist nuns, the Bhikkhuni Sangha, which flourished under Mahaprajapati's leadership and continued to exist in India for around 1,500 years. That's quite an achievement. From India, we know that King Ashoka's daughter, Sanghamitra, then took the Bhikkhuni lineage to Sri Lanka in the 4th century BCE. And then in the 5th century CE, the Sri Lankan nun called Devasak in the Chinese text took the lineage to China, from where it spread to Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, and other countries. Let's see. Oh, happy to hear that. There's a new statue of Mahaprajapati recently commissioned. And we also find images of her in Venerable Dhammananda's temple in Bangkok. I've seen them there, many in fact. So then, as Buddhism spread throughout Asia, the communities of fully ordained bhikshus were established one after the other and flourished. The communities of nuns were not always established alongside them. There is no conclusive evidence, for example, that the lineage of full ordination for women was established in Burma, Cambodia, Laos, Mongolia, Thailand, Russia, or Tibet, for example. The Bhikshuni lineage died out in India, Nepal, and Sri Lanka around the 11th century, but happily has been reintroduced in the past 20 years with the help of Bhikshunis from Korea and Taiwan. A vibrant international movement to reinstitute full ordination for women in all Buddhist societies is now underway. Oh, good. I hope we're able to save these comments so that we can go back and reference them later. According to the Guru Dharmas that the Buddha purportedly laid down as Mahapajapati's price of admission to the Sangha, included one that requires a dual ordination process. Okay, so this dual ordination process procedure for them seems to derive especially from the 8 Guru Dharmas. These rules vary in the different Vinaya schools, as we've learned, and their historicity is disputed. I hope in the coming years that more people will do research on all of these topics. This is such an exciting time for a nun to be living in, and I was so happy to share some of the wonderful work that many of you are doing and all of the research that's coming out with the nuns here at Nanmen, because they are not aware of what's happening in the other Buddhist traditions, and it's of vital importance to them. Obviously, they want to learn from all of you. So these rules, the 8 Guru Dharmas, stipulate the nun's dependence on the order of monks in important matters such as ordination, instruction, reinstatement, despite the fact that nuns' communities generally operate independently of monks. So the community here operates virtually independently, except that they do have a special place where monks can stay when they come to instruction. They're constructing a sima, and they're preparing to hold ordinations as well as to sponsor education, International Buddhist Studies Institute here next to the monastery. So the first Guru Dharma, which requires that even the most senior bhikshuni bow to a brand new bhikshu, is particularly grating to the sensibilities of women raised with ideals of gender equity or equality. Even if it could be established that Mahapajapati agreed to abide by these rules, it is far from clear why bhikshunis up to the present day should be obligated to follow them. Now, personally, I don't mind bowing to bhikshus, and it doesn't cost anything. It's a good exercise in humility. And but it does look a bit odd in the 21st century, especially in Western societies, to see nuns bowing to monks. As I say, I do so primarily as a strategy, because I find that the monks become very friendly when I bow to them. And so then they become very helpful. And I think that's a good thing. However, for many women, for many nuns, this could be an obstacle in their aspiration to practice as a renunciate. So this is one of the questions that I want to raise, is looking at both sides of the issue of how desirable bhikshuni ordination is, especially in the present day, especially for women of non-Asian traditions, and also for modern people in general, for whom some of these conventions may not come naturally. So the rule that nuns must receive full ordination from both bhikshunis and bhikshus means that in countries where there are no bhikshunis, women are not able to receive the precepts in their own tradition. In the present era of improved communications and transportation, however, it's theoretically possible for nuns to receive ordination from bhikshunis in another tradition. So, for example, I took ordination in Korea, then I went through the ordination process again in Taiwan in order to observe how the ordination was organized and how well, actually I was looking to see how close to the book, to the text, was the ordination organized. Okay, let's proceed here. Here's the picture of Sanghamitra. who has just landed in Sri Lanka after a treacherous journey by sea, and she's carrying the sapling of the Bodhi tree for which she has been long remembered. She was requested by Queen Anila and her women at court to conduct the full ordination. It's not clear how she gave the full ordination immediately at that time. That's what the texts say, the chronicles say. But we can only assume that they were perhaps living as nuns in preparation for her coming. But without her, they could not possibly have taken the Shramanarika precepts or the Shikshamana precepts. So that's something that requires further investigation. Now, we've all already studied these different types of precepts, the Upasaka precepts for the laywomen, the Shramanarika precepts for the novice nuns, and we mentioned a couple of weeks ago that the nuns in the Tibetan tradition take actually 36 precepts, which includes the 10 precepts and more. They are counted, therefore they're subdivided, and then many of the training precepts for the bhikshuni actually are included within their 36 precepts. Next we have the two-year shikshamana probationary period, and then the bhikshuni ordination or upasampada. The other category of 8 precept nuns is found in Burma, in Thailand, in Laos, and Cambodia. And also among certain nuns in the Tibetan tradition, in the Tibetan tradition also we find the Genshe, who may have the precepts of the Upasaka, they may have 8 precepts, or they may not have any precepts. They may be simply practicing as a nun, living as a nun, without ever having had the opportunity to receive precepts. So today, Buddhist nuns live in many different countries throughout the world, attempting to abide by codes of monastic discipline formulated in ancient India, while at the same time simultaneously adapting to local etiquette and contemporary cultural mores. Even in the most traditional Buddhist setting, it is difficult for nuns today to live on alms food and adhere strictly to all the precepts. And here we see a picture of a woman offering alms to monks in Laos, in southern Laos. But I was not able to find conclusive evidence that nuns go on the alms round. I heard some rumors, but I never saw them go for alms round. Then some said, well, they used to go for alms round, but they don't go anymore. And then someone told me that during certain meditation courses, they will sort of symbolically go on alms round. So I asked this question, of course, when I was in Laos, I visited 8 different monastic communities of women where the nuns all kept 8 precepts. And I asked whether they went on Dindabat, and most of them said no. But they did say that they'd heard of such a thing, and I think maybe by raising the question, I might have encouraged them to go out on alms round. They have enough food, but the food is generally brought to the monastery, often by their relatives or by a laywoman who takes it as her special duty and privilege to make sure that the nuns get what they need to eat. Now, in modern times, especially for Western women, the most glaring cultural discrepancy is the lack of full ordination for women in certain Buddhist traditions. Although today women's equal potentialities are recognized in virtually every field, male domination persists in Buddhist societies and is inscribed in monastic law. Age-old patriarchal patterns have been replicated in the Sangha, despite the fact that there is no philosophical justification for male dominance, either in the Buddhist monastic community or in Buddhist social institutions. So with a new global ethic of respect for human rights, the legislation of subordinate status for any group of individuals must be seriously questioned. Now, since 1987, Bhaktivedanta International Association of Buddhist Women has campaigned continuously for gender equity, especially with respect to education and ordination. We have avoided using the word equality, since equality is difficult to achieve in the best of ways. But inspired by Sakadita's biennial international conferences and grassroots social activism, Buddhist women in various countries have begun to work toward making coordination possible and available for women in all Buddhist traditions. The first breakthrough came, as we learned, in 1988 when the Nepali nun Damawati and two of her disciples received full ordination in a ceremony conducted at Shilai Temple in Los Angeles. Some Sri Lankan nuns were also ordained at that time, but as we learned, they were not supported sufficiently when they returned to Sri Lanka. Some are still bhikshunis today. I've met them. And some are highly educated. Others we were not able to track. We're not sure where they are living now. So we can't assume that they have all disrobed because I've met them and several are still in robes. The second breakthrough came in 1996 when Kusuma Devendra and nine nuns from Sri Lanka became bhikkhunis in a ceremony conducted in Sarnath, India. So another 20 Sri Lankan nuns received full ordination in 1996 at a ceremony conducted in Bodh Gaya, India. Now, I was fortunate to be a witness to all, well, I observed all three of these ordinations, and I was a witness in the third one, the one in Bodh Gaya. Since then, Sri Lankan bhikshunis have presided over numerous full ordination ceremonies for hundreds of Sri Lankan nuns. It's up to 1,000 now, and it's steadily increasing with annual ordinations being held in Sri Lanka. Nuns from Burma, Indonesia, Thailand, and other countries have also been ordained in these ceremonies. There's also been some progress toward achieving full ordination for women in the Tibetan tradition. His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama has repeatedly expressed his support for the full ordination of women, but states that such a decision must be made by a council of senior bhikshus and cannot be taken by him alone. He asked senior Western bhikshunis practicing in the Tibetan tradition to form a committee, the Committee for Bhikshuni Ordination in the Tibetan Tradition, to research ways to institute the bhikshuni lineage and to answer the objections of those who oppose it. In accordance with His Holiness's advice, these nuns, myself included, and many others have received full ordination in Hong Kong, Korea, Taiwan, Los Angeles, and elsewhere. But all of us are still concerned to open up opportunities for nuns in the Tibetan tradition who may find it difficult to travel to foreign countries. The reluctance to institute bhikshuni ordination in the Tibetan tradition primarily revolves around two issues. And I state this speaking from the Tibetan tradition, but I think it applies to the other countries where bhikshuni ordination is not currently available or where there are still strong objections from certain people to the coordination of women. Now, the first issue concerns the origins of the bhikshuni lineage practiced in China, Korea, Taiwan, and Vietnam, and whether that lineage has been transmitted uninterruptedly since the time of Mahaprajapati. It's very, very difficult to find historical evidence to support that this lineage has indeed continued for such a long period of time through the vicissitudes of history. And the best I've been able to do was to find four volumes from Baohuangshan, which is the renowned Vinaya Institute of China, which document about 500 years of fully ordained people, okay, fully ordained monks, and we presume nuns, but because the text says Jeshu, it means Vinaya Master. And it does not indicate the gender of the Vinaya Master. So we could presume that the Vinaya masters that have been recorded in these books were bhikshus, but there's no way to be certain about that. I presented these books. I found that after finding them in Hong Kong, I presented them to His Holiness, and they have been in Dharamsala for the last 30 years, but there still seem to be questions about the lineage. So ascertaining an unbroken lineage throughout 2,500 years is going to be very difficult. I don't know if we're ever going to be able to manage that. Now, the second question, or second issue, that those opponents, let's say, raise concerning the ordination is about the method of conducting the ordination in traditions that have no living Bhikshuni lineage. The Theravada and Tibetan Buddhist traditions have preserved the Bhikshuni Vinaya texts, but do not have living Bhikshuni lineages in their own traditions to conduct ordinations. Therefore, the question is which method of conducting the Bhikshuni ordination is preferable and most likely to be considered valid. First of all, an ordination by bhikshus alone, and I'm quite happy and interested to hear more of the arguments for ordination, valid ordination by bhikshus alone that have been raised in this forum. The second option is for the nuns in these traditions to receive ordination from bhikshus and bhikshunis who all belong to either the Chinese or the Korean or the Vietnamese tradition. This is the option that has been taken by those of us who have traveled to Korea or Taiwan, Hong Kong, and so forth. Now, the third option is for these nuns to receive ordination from bhikshus and bhikshunis who belong to different Vinaya traditions. So, for example, if the Tibetan bhikshus were to conduct an ordination together with bhikshunis who had been ordained in the Chinese or Korean or Vietnamese traditions. This third procedure was used to restore the Bhikshuni Sangha in Sri Lanka. And after that, subsequent ordinations were conducted by the Sri Lankan nuns themselves. So it means that, as has been mentioned by other speakers, as long as the initial ordination is conducted by both bhikshus and bhikshunis, then within 10 or 12 years, the ordination could then be conducted by those bhikshunis themselves, together with bhikshus of their own traditions. So this would be a kind of interim ordination, or an ordination that's held in a particular way for a certain number of years, and then is integrated or assimilated into the tradition. And I think that we could mention that this is the way the Bhikshu lineage was revived in Tibet. And that history has all been published, and I think people are aware of it. So both Buddhists and feminists around the world have taken an active interest in finding an equitable solution to this dilemma. Buddhists often claim that women and men have equal opportunities to achieve liberation, but the lack of equal opportunities for women to receive ordination contradicts this claim. As long as women in some countries lack access to full ordination, they lack the optimum conditions for fulfilling their liberating potential or their enlightenment potential. So even if they have equal opportunities in theory, it's very difficult to put that into practice if one does not have adequate food, housing, education, healthcare, and so forth. So as long as Buddhist women anywhere are deprived of equal opportunities, then Buddhist women overall are deprived. To be consistent, Buddhists have no choice but to work for gender equity and women's religious rights, which after all are human rights, beginning with our own traditions. So, to learn more about nuns of the Theravada tradition from my own experience, this is a picture of a Vipassana center, a community of nuns in southern Laos. And you can see that on the wall is a picture of a female donor. So I find this quite remarkable. We see donors painted into murals in the Dunhuang caves, for example. but I haven't seen it any in recent history. And so I'm, so I was very happy to see that this donor has been honored for her contributions in the mural. The same monastery found another mural on the opposite wall, which illustrates the four communities, the four quarters of the ideal Buddhist community, which means the bhikshus, bhikshunis, upasakas, and upasikas. So here you see members of the four communities holding up the Dharma wheel. You have the upasakas, you have the upasikas, you have the bhikshus, but no bhikkhuni. But here we do have a nun. So in Laos, the nuns are called Meikau, and she is an eight-precept nun wearing white robes, and she didn't quite get her hands on the wheel, but at least she got in the picture. So in this community, nuns meditate and chant along with the monks. Some of them come from families who are donors of the monastery. Spatially, however, you can see that there is a difference. They are subordinate to the monks spatially and socially. Then on the platform, you see a young man who is taking ordination for the second time. He is a layperson, but he is up on the platform along with the bhikkhus. Nuns don't seem to resent this. In fact, they seem very happy to have a place where they can practice. They told me that the monks go for pindapat and bring back whatever they collect and share it with the nuns. So they seem to have a very harmonious community where they can all get on with their practice, despite the fact that the nuns are not fully ordained. On the left-hand side seem to have women. This one? No, it's a man. They're all male on the platform. I'm not sure exactly which one you're referring to. Oh, in the mural painting. Okay, let's go back to the mural painting. The third. Now, you're right. This could be. It's possible. It could be a bhikkhuni. And taking a second look, yes. But then look, this bhikkhu also looks rather feminine. And she's not wearing the vest, which is not conclusive evidence either way. She's rather, he or she is rather androgynous, right? In any case, the hips look female. Oh, there we go. Okay. So an art historian would have a good time with this. Yes, indeed. Her hips definitely look female. Okay. So maybe bhikkhuni got in the picture, even though real-life bhikkhunis have never existed. They are being portrayed. That's a positive sign for the future, isn't it? Okay, now here's an example of eight precept nuns. Eight precept holders. They are not nuns. They are laywomen, upasikas, who have taken eight precepts for 24 hours. This is during a funeral ceremony. My friend's boss died, and I got to this funeral. The male relatives all became monks for a day, 24 hours. Freshly shaven, in order to accumulate merit, in order to dedicate it to the deceased. I didn't see any women who had shaved their heads, but I found quite a few of the female relatives had taken eight precepts for 24 hours, so that's why they're dressed in white. Okay, here are two Lao nuns, or Meikau. They hold eight precepts. The one on the right is quite extraordinary. She went to Thailand, learned Thai, studied meditation for many years, then went to Burma, learned Burmese and English, attended the Buddhist Academy in Mandalay, and got a bachelor's degree, returned to Laos, and is starting a monastery, which she hopes will have a school that will be able to offer Buddhist education for some young women and hopefully attract young women to become nuns in the future. At the moment, because the status of nuns is so low, the 8 communities that I visited only had older nuns in them. I did not see any younger nuns. With a little encouragement, I think it could happen, but they need more support, and they need a Buddhist education. Not everyone is willing to go to Thailand and Burma and learn, you know, different languages in order to learn Buddhism. So we need less emphasis on building multi-million-dollar temples and more emphasis on educating Buddhists so that they can maintain their own cultural traditions, in my opinion. Anyway, here we see the first two nuns that Venerable Dhammananda spoke about who took shamanic precepts but were forced to disrobe. So the Bhikshuni ordination was not available in Thailand until very recently. This is the Mahaprajapati College for Women in northeastern Thailand. It was established 15 years ago and is offering education to Buddhist nuns and lay women. They also admit foreign students. Here are 3 nuns from Bangladesh that we sent to study there. They learn Thai, and they have graduated. 2 have gone on to get master's degrees. 2 are back in Bangladesh teaching. And then a 5th one is currently completing her bachelor's degree and planning to go on for a master's degree. So we can see that with just a little bit of encouragement and support, women are willing to become nuns and are willing and are anxious to learn Buddhism and are emerging as teachers. So, okay. Here is a nun from Shanti Ashok, which is a rather controversial monastic organization that keeps the Vinaya very strictly. They don't wear shoes. They don't carry umbrellas. The nuns are highly educated, and they keep 10 precepts. This nun was a professor of physics at UC Riverside before becoming a nun. So their community is highly respected by their supporters, but it seemed to have posed something of a threat to the monastic establishment in Thailand, and their founder, Bodhirok, known as Bodhirok, was forcibly disrobed. The nuns were arrested and eventually released after a 3-year court case, but they do not wear either the robes of a Bhikkhuni or the robes of a Meiji. They opted for the gray robes that you see here. And here are the nuns of Burma. They're known as Thilin Shin, as we learned. They are 8 precept holders. I had heard that some have 9 or 10 precepts, but Professor Kawanami says that they have 8. And she also confirmed that they have many opportunities for study, which I think is a wonderful thing. And many have taken advantages of these opportunities and attained highest degrees in Pali and Abhidharma and so forth. I look forward to an opportunity to visit Burma and meet with the nuns and talk with them personally. The nuns collect uncooked rice and donations, can accept donations of money since they don't have that precept to handle money. This, of course, means that they have more time cooking, chopping, and cleaning up and so forth. But they have enough to eat. Even if many of the donations come from their own relatives, they are managing in their communities. And they have many young girls joining their communities. So also in Burma, the phenomenon of temporary ordination means that girls who work in offices and so forth will go for meditation retreats for a month each year and live as nuns for a year or possibly even more. In Burma, it's possible to get a month off each year. Not bad, to go for meditation retreat. So we hope, I mean, possibly this leads to women deciding that they like meditation and wanting to pursue the monastic life, but we don't have statistics on that. This photo is from the ordination, Bhikshuni ordination, held at the Chinese monastery in Bodh Gaya in 1998. 132 people were ordained in this ordination, including over 30 from Sri Lanka, most of whom were the heads of their monasteries. So we've discussed a bit the problem with young nuns wishing to become bhikshunis when their teachers are not fully ordained. If a junior takes full ordination and she then outs in the monastic formulation, her teacher, which is awkward, who bows to whom? For example, she should bow to her teacher, but once she becomes a bhikshuni, her teacher is supposed to bow to her. And so in these monasteries where the senior nuns took bhikshuni ordination, then we don't have that problem. And we also have monasteries in Sri Lanka where bhikkhunis and 10 precept nuns, Dasa Srila Matas, live side by side, harmoniously. I visited a couple of years ago a monastery where two sisters, both living in the monastery, one was the abbess, was a bhikkhuni, and her sister was Dasa Srila Mata. And they seem to be getting on just fine. So that means that there will be different options, even within one monastery. I just wanted to mention that because Dr. Salgado mentioned the problem that there's some conflicts or tensions, perhaps, between those who have received the bhikkhuni ordination and those who are practicing as Dasa Srila Matas. In time, probably this will resolve itself as bhikkhuni ordination becomes more widely available and the older generation passes on. We shall see. Here are the nuns of Nepal. In the center is Venerable Dhammawati. She is the most highly respected nun in Nepal, especially in the Newar community, the Theravada Buddhist community in the Kathmandu Valley. She escaped, ran away from home at the age of 13, spent 13 years in Burma studying, achieved the Acharya degree, Dhammacharya degree, and returned to Nepal, where she was really key in reviving Theravada Buddhism in the Kathmandu Valley, but also throughout Nepal. So she has monasteries both in Kathmandu and in Lumbini. She hosted the Sakyadita Conference in 2000. She has 400 ordained disciples, 200 of whom are bhikkhunis. And she has sent her, she went to Los Angeles and there received ordination with two of her disciples. Other of her disciples were ordained in China. Sorry. And I learned from her disciples that before they went to China, she knew some of her Dharma brothers in Burma who said, if you allow your disciples to go to China to receive bhikkhuni ordination, you will never be able to speak to your teacher again. She sent them anyway. And she sent her disciples also to the ordination in Bodh Gaya. She's fearless. And she's still in Kathmandu. We've just been able to send someone to interview her. Her disciples have gone on to establish monasteries throughout the Kathmandu Valley in places where Buddhism was really nearly extinct. So nuns can be so valuable in helping to preserve Buddhism and to disseminate Buddhism because they have time. Not that lay women couldn't do this. Of course they can. But lay women, as we know, have many other responsibilities and don't always have sufficient time for study and practice as much as they would like to. So the nuns can spend all of their time on their monastic duties, to teaching and studying and so forth. So here are some examples that you have. You may also notice in this picture, Chuying Dongma, who's called the singing nun. Now, she has dressed as a nun since she was a child, and she holds five precepts. So she falls in a category that is not a traditional category. And in 2007, at the Congress on the Status of Women in Buddhism, she became the spokesperson for the nuns of the Tibetan tradition. Because she speaks English with an American accent, she was delegated to translate. However, the views that she expressed may or may not have represented the views of all of the Tibetan nuns and Himalayan nuns who were gathered there. Because she is not a shamanerica, she may or may not be interested in becoming preordained herself. Therefore, I think that we really need to talk more to the nuns themselves, those who are shamanericas, who are living in monasteries. And when we do, we find that many of them are very interested in receiving bhikshuni ordination. Yes, these nuns are bhikshunis, and they're dressed in the pink robes because their teacher, Venerable Dhammawati, studied in Burma. And when they came back, when she returned to Burma, it was still at a time when Buddhism had previously been outlawed. The monks had fled to India. It was a Hindu kingdom. The Buddhists were oppressed. And so when she returned from Burma, she decided to continue to wear the robes that she had worn in Burma. I know that at least one of her disciples dresses in brown robes, Venerable Dhamma Vijaya, who is a bhikkhuni. So I think that the nuns have the option to wear the brown robes if they should wish to do so. So these things just sort of become accepted as tradition. And you'll see the garment is orange and that the shawl that they wear is brown. So it's a sort of a median solution, a middle way solution to the question of proper attire. Last year I was in Indonesia, and a monk there had been to Burma and had brought back many sets of pink robes for the nuns in Indonesia. He was formerly a Muslim who had converted to Buddhism, and being fluent in English has become a popular teacher in Indonesia. But I had to raise the question with him and say, you know, that pink really isn't the perfect color for nuns because it's considered a very attractive color. And that since the nuns in Indonesia are already wearing the orange and rust-colored robes, why in the world would he want to introduce pink robes? So he did not accept my reasoning, but I did put forth my plea three times. And at least I hope he began to think about this. It caused quite a controversy in Indonesia. About once the nuns have achieved the right to wear the yellow robe, or the ochre robe, or the brown robe, why would they then revert to wearing, well, it's worn by a precept nuns. So since we're having our Sankhedita conference in Indonesia next June, please save the date. I'm sure that this question will be raised again, and we'll have more lively conversations about it. Here is an ordination of bhikkhunis held in Northern California, and some very prominent nuns, including Venerable Tathamoka here, Venerable Adimutta. And this was witnessed, attended by some very highly respected bhikkhus, such as Bhikkhu Pasmano and so forth, and Bhikkhu Punaratana. So these ordinations are accepted. The nuns are supported primarily by Thai disciples, but they are getting their requisites and they're able to live as bhikkhunis without handling money in their communities. So it shows that it is possible even in the United States. Before, we all used to joke that we would get arrested if we went for alms in the United States, but now actually they've proved us wrong. I don't think anyone got arrested. You know, moving to the Mahayana tradition, here's my own ordination in Taiwan. I told you that I went through the ordination again without taking the precepts again because I wanted to observe how the ordination was conducted. In fact, this was my ordination in Korea, which I attended accidentally. I was headed for Taiwan, where they, the famous Nan Shao Yun Bashi had helped me to register for the ordination and sort of signed on as my Bichin preceptor. And then on the way had discovered that a full ordination was being held in Korea that would be conducted by Bichus and Bichunis. So when I had the opportunity to take it from both Bichus and Bichunis, I definitely wanted to do that. And the reason was that I knew that when I returned to Dharamsala, where I'd been studying for many years, the first question I would be asked was, well, who ordained you? And they would be expecting me to say Bhikkhu Sampong, because most of the ordinations at that time were conducted by Bhikkhu Sampong. So if I could say that I was ordained by Bhikkhus and Bhikkhunis, this ordination would have a better chance of acceptance in the Tibetan community. And so I was happy to get this opportunity. It was the first time that a dual ordination had been held in Korea in probably 100 years. And this is also an English bhikshuni named Jampa, who'd been ordained in the Tibetan tradition. She'd then been ordained as a bhikkhuni in Hong Kong, but only by bhikkhus. So she wanted to receive the dual ordination, and they allowed her to do that. So the training was in Korea, of course, requires 6 years. From the time, first you go in as a hinja, you go in as a sort of cook's helper. You do all the work around the monastery for 6 months. And that training is so difficult that most people can't hack it and drop out. So if you can make it to that 6 month, period, a probationary period, then you are eligible to go and take the novice ordination. But novice ordinations are held in national ordinations, large ordinations, to keep the standards high at the same time as the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni ordinations. But after taking the Shramanarik ordination, you're required to train in a monastery very strictly for at least 6 years. And I mean, you don't step one toe over the boundary of the monastery limits with boundaries without permission, or it's sayonara. Really have to keep the precepts very, very well, in addition to the monastic rules that are laid down by that particular monastery. So only after 6 years of strenuous training does anyone make it to the ordination, the full ordination platform. I was very fortunate in that I was introduced to the ordination by a highly respected bhikkhu, Pongjang Kusang Sin, who was the leading Zen master of the 20th century in Korea. He gave me my name, and he put me on the bus with some 30, 40 monks to take the ordination. And one of the precept masters was from that monastery, Song Kong Sa. And he was in the line where we had to give our credentials. And when I arrived, they asked my name. Then they asked who ordained you. And I said the 16th Gyalpo Karmapa. And the bhikkhu was not very open to my, he wondered who this was and what right did I have to take ordination. But fortunately, the bhikkhu who was standing beside him, Bonsong Sinan, sort of vouched for me and said, it's okay, let her go. So I had been a Shaman Erica for 5 years by that point. But I think without his intervention, I might not have been allowed to receive the
Bhikkhuni ordination. I was very happy to meet him again last year in Korea. Now, here's an ordination in Taiwan, and I had a hard time finding photos of an ordination in Taiwan because generally it's there not open to the public. But this is Venerable Sheng Yan and some of his disciples, Bhikkhu and Bhikkhunis. Ordinations are held annually in Taiwan before they were nationalized, and there was, at the time when I observed the ordination in 1982, at Haiming Temple. There was only one per year given, but now they're being offered at various monasteries around the country. The standards are still extremely high. The nuns get a month of strenuous training. The disciplinary standards especially among the generation under 60 are very, very high, and some over 60. And so these nuns then all get an equal kind of training. And they also study the precepts during the ordination. They learn how to stand, how to sit, how to bow, how to wear the robes, how to eat with the bowls in the Taiwanese way, which comes from China. And many of them have university degrees. So the big rush for ordination that we saw in the 1990s is over. But hundreds of young women, highly educated young women, are still joining the monasteries here in Taiwan. This is an ordination in China, and we'll see that lots of men and women are becoming ordained in China. I cannot vouch for the standards because I have not observed an ordination there. I do know from a friend who was a bhikkhu, who was ordained as a bhikkhu in China in 1982, that at his ordination, the discipline was extremely strict. I mean, they had to kneel for hours on stone, and I mean, it was really tough. So I would like to observe one, actually. I met a nun who had recently conducted a full ordination for nuns only, 360 nuns at her temple. And I can say that all of the nuns that I met in China were very well disciplined. And they are very careful to observe the Vinaya procedures as they're set forth in the Vinaya texts. Here the nuns are registering the ordination. Here they are doing, these are the ordination masters. You can tell from the red robes. And they're holding the sitting palms and so forth. Here's an ordination, a picture of an ordination held in 2013, taken at the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Northern California. As you see, it says threefold platform pre-transmission commemoration. So in the Chinese tradition, it's customary to offer both the Shramanarika precepts and the Bhikkhuni precepts and the Bodhisattva precepts all within a certain period of time, which is somewhere between 30 days and 60 days, depending on the person who hosts the ordination. The list of temples that are vying to host the ordination is very long, so I think you have to wait for another 100 years to get the opportunity. But they are held in this way. Even if someone has been a Shramanarika for many years, she would then take the precepts again in this triple platform ordination. It's not absolutely required that one take the Bodhisattva precepts. I've heard of people declining to take the Bodhisattva precepts during their Bhikkhuni ordination. They seem to be able to make arrangements for that. By the way, in China, in the ordinations, they no longer do the three burns on the head. In Taiwan, three burns are still allowed, but in China, they're not. I think that came from the government. Oh, a correction here. About one-third of our support comes from the Thai community. Thank you for clarifying. Oh, I'm sorry, one-quarter. One-quarter of our support comes from the Thai community. And the rest of the support comes from other people, I suppose. Okay, good. Now, this picture was taken at the Triple Platform ordination held at Chilai in 1988. It was headed by the Fo Kwang Shan organization, but bhikshus from China were involved, were included. I know that because I had the opportunity to meet Mengzang Huashi. Mengzang is a very famous Buddhist master in China today. As he told me that as a young man, he had studied in Tibet for 3 years. He had studied Mamrim and other texts. He had spoken, been able to speak Tibetan at that time, but had forgotten it. Later on, he was imprisoned for having been to Tibet and so forth, but he was released, and he's now teaching at a nunnery at Wutashan. This is a nunnery, a training institute for nuns, which I visited 2 years ago. They have over 800 nuns, a very strict discipline, and he is an excellent teacher for them. They have many other teachers as well. I might mention that they're also surveillance cameras at that temple. But anyway, so I tried to emulate the behavior. So here is a picture of that ordination at Chilai Temple, where Ayakema was ordained for one, and a number of well-known nuns, including, as mentioned, the Nepali nuns and the Sri Lankan nuns. This is the ordination in 1998 in Bodh Gaya, with 132 nuns being ordained, including over 30 Sri Lankan nuns, picture you saw earlier. I was a witness at this ordination, and Thupten Shud also a witness. There was also a Korean bhikkhuni witness. There were monks of various traditions involved in the ordination. These are the bhikshuni precept masters. But among the bhikshu precept masters, there were Thai, Ladakhi, and Korean masters too, I believe. So it was an international organization. Now, this is not the first time that an international ordination has been held, because we know that the City of 10,000 Buddhas, which is renowned for its strict discipline, has also been conducting international ordinations for a long time. They've included Theravada monks in their ordinations too. So that's not terribly unusual. I'd like to... Are you sure that they are single ordinations? I received different information, but let's check it out. Let's check it out. Okay, so this is the way the Taiwanese Fo Kwang Shan community conducted the ordination. And one very special point was that at this ordination, nuns from the community in central India, often called Dalits or the oppressed, received ordination. And as I recall, there were 18 of them. Yujian Li has written about this in her article in the book Innovative Buddhist Women Swimming Against Stream. They arrived in Bodh Gaya, they have been barefoot and in rags, but they were determined to take bhikshuni ordination. So we went and got them new robes and some rubber slippers, and they were so happy, and they did very well during the ordination, observing all the discipline. And as far as I know, they're all still, the bhikkhunis, two of them have passed away. But other nuns have, in the meantime, also become bhikkhunis. And Venerable Tata Loka has also conducted trainings for nuns in India. So that is a wonderful contribution. The Dalit community, now I'm going to use the word Dalit, though I know that some people in this community would prefer not to use the word Dalit. But then there are others who don't like the term New Buddhist either, because they say they were Buddhists all along. that they've been Buddhists from the beginning, and it was because they did not accept the idea of caste that they have been outcasted over many centuries. When we first heard this theory, some of us thought it sounded pretty weird, but pretty wild, I should say. But recent anthropological research has been coming up with some evidence that actually these claims may be true, that the Buddhist communities of India, in Maharashtra and Orissa and so forth, may have been gone, may in fact have been Buddhist continuously for many centuries. So in any case, they're very proud of their Buddhist identity, number somewhere over 12 million now, and they would really like to have some of you come and teach Buddhism in their communities. Here's a photo of an ordination held in Singapore recently. So in earlier years, the monks and nuns from Singapore would have to travel to Hong Kong or Taiwan to receive ordination. So it's worthy of note that ordinations are being held in Singapore itself, in their own language and so forth. In fact, I'm not sure exactly what language they would use. I'd like to learn more. I can see some Koreans were involved in the ordination, and at least one person in Tibetan wrote, so, and here's another Korean. So I'll have to check it out. I just found this photo on the internet, actually. I'd like to learn about that. Here, back to Korea, is a photo of my teacher, Haechun Sinim, who was a Zen master, but she was also the leading bhikkhuni master on my ordination, and her story will be published soon in a new book on eminent Buddhist women. Here's a photo of the education that the bhikkhunis in Korea received. They have actually had many opportunities. They struggled very hard in the beginning after the war to reestablish their monasteries, and they've done remarkable work. The bhikkhunis in Korea number about equally with monks, and their educational standards are very high. There are quite a few who have received PhDs either in Japan or in Korea or in the United States, and are now serving as professors in Buddhist universities, highly respected. I'd like to mention regarding the first Buddha-dharma that the last time I was in Korea, two years ago, I noticed that there is a trend for when the bhikkhunis go to bow to the bhikkhus, the young bhikkhus will often bow back to them. So this I have not seen in any other country. And I thought it was quite remarkable. And I was told that it's not unusual. What I witnessed actually happens rather a lot among open-minded young bhikkhus. So here are Korean nuns attending Sakyadita conferences. They've been sent, not unusual, good. I'm very glad to hear that. Because the Korean nuns have been, despite the language problem, have been attending the Sakyadita conferences for many years, and we do have Korean translation provided for them, very fine Korean translation team, equivalent to our remarkable Taiwan translation team and our remarkable Vietnamese translation team. So reaching, in order to reach to the grassroots, because not everyone, as we know, has educational opportunities. Millions of Buddhist women are still illiterate, living in poverty, living under political oppression, and so forth. So we want to be optimistic, but we also don't want to forget that there's still much work to be done. Now, here's an altar from Vietnam. I was in a temple, and I saw this altar, and I was really pleased to see that the Vietnamese Buddhists honor their bhikkhuni elders. This was not an isolated example. In every bhikkhuni temple I visited, I saw such an altar commemorating great nuns of the past. In Vietnam, there are many princesses in the records who became bhikkhunis. So this is taken from a tombstone of a bhikkhuni who was as a princess in Hue. This was a notable ordination in Vietnam from 1957-58, remarkable because many of these nuns became leaders of the Bích Quy Ni community in Vietnam. They had a very difficult time during the war years. They had to survive by, actually, they were not allowed to stay in their monasteries often. Or if they stayed in their monasteries, they were not allowed to accept donations from the lay community. So they started making incense, making tofu, making New Year's candies and so forth. And many of the monasteries still continue this tradition to demonstrate self-sufficiency to the lay community, that they're willing to work to support themselves. And they would, during those years, they would continue their practices. Now, many were required to work in the fields. But they would get up at 4 in the morning and take from 4 to 6 in the morning, and go to the fields and work all day and return at night and meditate again from 8 to 10 in the evening. So in these ways, you can see that they accepted and weathered great hardships in order to preserve the Bích Quy Ni community in Vietnam. The nun in the foreground is the leading nun of North Vietnam. And this is a community in South Vietnam in Ho Chi Minh City. And notice here that the young acolytes, we could call them acolytes, shave half of their hair. So they're allowed to stay in the monastery. They go to school in the daytime, and then they serve in the temple. And if they work out well, then they're allowed to become shamanericas. So there's a rigorous testing period. After the war years, women in Vietnam experienced such great, terrible suffering that they wanted to join the monasteries in droves by the thousands. And eventually they had to impose an educational requirement of 12th grade graduation in order to limit the numbers. So that was a necessity, sort of financial necessity, but it also helped to raise the standards of education among nuns in Vietnam. Now, today there are 3 Buddhist monastic universities in Taiwan. Here's a monastery built by and for nuns. And there's another training institute nearby, very high standards of Zen. There are both Zen monasteries and Amitabha practice monasteries in Vietnam. There are also some Theravada monasteries. Okay, now the cursor is not moving. Venerable, I think I'm going to need your help. Can you please move to the next slide? Time's up. Work is over. Can you hear me? Okay. No problem. Oh, great. Okay. So here are the nuns up in the Himalayas. I think we lost a few slides, but they're debating philosophy. Here, some of them are even learning how to use computers. Next slide, please. Okay. I wanted to take up several questions, but I'm sorry to see that our time is really running out. I wanted to take up the question in particular about whether or not nuns in these countries are interested in receiving the Bích Quy Ni ordination. Now, to my mind, this is whether one takes full ordination or not is a personal question. It's a personal matter whether one wants to devote their life to monastic practice. Even among my own nuns in India, I have never encouraged them or much less required them to take full ordination. I know that they're waiting to take ordination with the Holiness Dalai Lama. I've let them know that the Taiwanese Buddhist community would be happy to fly them to Taiwan to participate in the Bích Quy Ni ordination here. So far, they have not availed themselves of that opportunity. So they want to take ordination within their own tradition from their own bhikshus. I think this is also true in the Theravada countries. As we've seen from what happened in Sri Lanka, the nuns prefer to take ordination from bhikshus of their own tradition and to consider themselves Theravada bhikshus rather than Dhammapada bhikkhunis, even if those were the precepts that might have been transmitted during the first few ordinations. So these pictures are taken at the Sakadita conference in Korea. You can see the very multinational, that nuns, different orders and different countries are meditating together, chanting together, developing friendships together, encouraging each other on the path. And I think we already saw this next slide. And so these transnational networks, I think, are highly important. And I would refute the claim that Western feminist bhikshunis are trying to talk the nuns into something they don't want. They didn't have education, and many didn't have sufficient food years ago. But in helping them to, so this is the Committee on Bhikkhuni Ordination in the Tibetan Tradition that was appointed by His Holiness about 6 years ago. He gave us the prize money that he'd gotten from Switzerland by 50,000 Swiss francs, asked us to meet and to figure out a way to bring the Bhikkhuni Ordination into the Tibetan Tradition. We've met about 6 or 7 times now, and we've presented our findings. Our research continues. We're waiting for a report from a committee of Bhikkhu scholars, Tibetan Bhikkhu scholars in Dharamsala, to see what they've found. We heard that about half of them support Bhikkhuni ordination and about half of them are opposed. So I'm not sure how, I hope they find a middle way. Questions? Do we have some questions? I know that much of this information is already familiar to many of you, but now I have more comments. But I'd be happy to answer any questions since our time is so limited. Okay, so it's been suggested that Western women, especially Western feminists, are to blame for trying to pressure nuns in various countries into taking a bhikkhuni ordination that they do not want. But I think here we can't separate the debates about women renunciates from issues of power. And the fact that the bhikkhus are still in control of the instruments of ordination. And we need the bhikkhus in order to hold a recognized ordination ceremony. Therefore, they are in a position of power, and the bhikkhunis are in an unequal power relationship, not to mention those who are still shamanericans. So we find that nuns in the Tibetan tradition, for example, are being told by their teachers that 10 precepts are enough for them. There's no reason for them to take bhikkhuni ordination. And here the implication is that, well, if they eat solid food after 12 o'clock, they're not worthy of becoming a bhikshuni. However, we know that many Tibetan bhikshus also take solid food after noon. It's supposed to be if you're sick or if you're traveling or if it disturbs your meditation. They have 3 caveats. So it's also said that bhikshuni ordination isn't necessary for these women. But if it's necessary or important for bhikshus, why shouldn't it be important for nuns? We must recognize that Buddhist nuns across cultures are not monolithic. We can see that from the presentations. Even within one tradition, the nuns have many different perspectives, different lifestyles, different levels of education, different aspirations. We want to honor that. And the Western women are definitely not trying to touch anyone and say anything. Reports that Svakidita held an ordination in Taiwan are false. It's been reported that Svakidita organized an ordination in Taiwan for money, but this is impossible because we've never even organized an ordination at all. I think that the concerns that the international community has about the living conditions of nuns is valid, is warranted, because I've just been talking with the Taiwan medical team that went to Sangha Nitra to do medical checks on my own nuns that I've been helping for 25 years, and they found that they're all malnourished, except for three, right? Three? Mm-hmm. All were suffering from malnutrition. So how can someone practice, and this is with support, with Western support, and still they're not getting adequate nutrition. So how can one practice well and study well if they are not getting the nutrition they need, if they don't have the health care that they need, they don't have shelter, proper shelter and so forth. The nuns that I showed you in living in Tibet the other day and living in wooden boxes with plastic on top, I mean, how can they possibly achieve enlightenment? I know they're going for it, but I would like to see them have a little bit better living conditions. And if that means that we're criticized for having some colonialist agenda, well, I think if they talk to the nuns will see it differently. The nuns are very happy with the support that they receive from their friends in different communities and different countries. So that's one thing I wanted to take up. The suggestion that nuns should not be concerned about their own welfare, that they should concentrate on meditation, I think that's a bit disingenuous. You see, suggesting that nuns should not be concerned about their own physical welfare because that's a worldly matter, well, I think that borders on intimidation. And also the idea that women should, that the nuns should not aspire to become the ordination because they're unworthy, that's also a kind of intimidation. I think that we should instead encourage the nuns rather than sort of deliberately trying to prevent them from acquiring the knowledge and the requisites and the ordination that they need in order to fulfill their potential as human beings, right? So today the standards of nuns everywhere is improving. And I think that that's a really good thing. I hope that they will continue to improve. In Laos and Cambodia, the nuns are in dire need of support on all levels. Okay, here we have a question. What is the tendency of ordained nuns to question skeptically the legitimacy of ordinations of others that perhaps had less ideal conditions or ritual adherence? Well, yes, I have noticed that nuns who are very strict about the Vinaya may sometimes imply that others who are not as strict are somehow, well, and it's just left as a dot, dot, dot. The legitimacy of ordinations, certain ordinations, yes, I have heard ordinations at certain monasteries be regarded more highly than monasteries held at other ordinations, at other monasteries. I think that for many years, the ordinations in Taiwan were regarded more highly than the ordinations held in Hong Kong. And that was especially because the ordinations in Hong Kong usually only lasted for 5 days, whereas the ordinations in Taiwan lasted for at least 1 month with lots of training and so forth. The ordination procedure itself usually only lasts for a few hours anyway. So I don't know that could be used to disqualify or to actually question the legitimacy of an ordination. The ordinations held in Hong Kong are legitimate, as far as we know, insofar as they were conducted by Ten Bhikkhus, and they were recognized by the Hong Kong Buddhist Association and so forth. But I know that there was a preference for ordinations that were more, that offered more in-depth training. Okay, one group that had suffered from this, the 1996 ordination batch. Well, okay, I was also a witness to the 1996 ordination in Sarnath. And it was clear that there were nuns there, but it was not clear that they were offering, that they were involved in the dual ordination process. So yes, there were 10 Korean bhikkhunis there, and not vouched that they conducted the bhikkhuni part of the ordination as it would have been in the dual ordination. But there were definitely 10 bhikkhus there, 10 bhikkhus who were conducting the ordination, and so it should be considered legitimate. Yes, definitely. And that group was also, they were real pioneers. I'm not sure who would be questioning the legitimacy, but as we know from Professor Salgado's talk and her book, that there is some tension between different groups who may be trying to maybe even monopolize the ordination process in Sri Lanka. I'm always in favor of diversity. That's what I heard them like. They did, yes. I did not see them officiate. There might have been some part of the ordination that I did not witness, but that's to the best of my knowledge. Okay. So, we know that once ordination is available and sanctioned by the nuns' teachers, many nuns are happy to receive the ordination. I think that if the nuns in Dharamsala, throughout India and Nepal, had the opportunity to take ordination with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, virtually all of them would. I think then they would get over any reluctance and feelings of inadequacy that they may be feeling, as long as it were sanctioned by His Holiness, if he gave them the go-ahead, even if he gave the go-ahead to other monks to give the ordination. I think that they would all take the opportunity to receive ordination. So I think it's definitely demeaning to represent nuns as opportunists who are only seeking access to ordination in order to gain certain privileges. We never hear that accusation leveled against monks. So why would someone, that nuns are only taking ordination in order to get some special benefits for themselves? But I find that rather outrageous. The concern for the nuns' welfare is really important. When we look back to 1987, the conditions of nuns at that time, when many of the nuns were illiterate, they were hungry, they were malnourished, and so forth, the fact that ordinations have been facilitated in many different countries has worked to raise the status of nuns in general, including their educational opportunities, the respect from the lay community, the support that they get from the lay community. It's had many positive side effects for the nuns overall. So I believe that if the Upasampada is liberating for monks, it should be liberating for nuns as well. So of course it's true that women can shave their heads and put on robes and practice the Dharma very well without taking the Upasampada. But I think that it's also true, as Venerable Anilayo has shown in his recent article, that Mahaprajapati was not content with this median step. She herself, our foremother, was the one who said, well, you know, that's not enough. She advocated for full ordination. And she was the the trendsetter. She was the standard, the model for Bhikkhuni ordination henceforth. And therefore, since the Buddha himself gave the ordination, and since Mahaprajapati herself took the ordination and modeled what women can do, then I think definitely we should have those opportunities available. So anyone who wishes to take advantage of them, which is not to say everyone, I've always advocated for quality over quantity. Okay, now a question from a different angle. How do you think it is not to approach and care for the priests and the practice paradigm as the institutions? Well, if someone is dissuaded from taking Bhikkhuni ordination because of the eight Gurudharmas, maybe their resolve, their determination is not strong enough. That's one possible answer to this question. In some ordinations, the eight Gurudharmas are actually recited, but I'm not certain that people are always aware of what that they have been recited or what they entail. Of course, it's a historical impossibility to rewrite the Vinaya texts. We can't do that. The eight Gurudharmas are in the texts. We can't just simply delete them. We have to deal with them, but we can reinterpret them. So, as I say, this process of bowing, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis bowing to each other in Korea, I think is a lovely option for modern people. And maybe that's one way, or modern Asian, Western people. I think that we can explain the historical circumstances, that the Buddha made it pretty clear that the renunciants of other traditions did not bow to nuns. And considering the patriarchal structures of the time, it would have appeared very odd. It might not appear so odd. I mean, here in Taiwan, sometimes men bow to me, not bhikkhus, but laymen. And I know that throughout Taiwan, laymen bow to bhikkhunis, and it's not regarded as unusual at all. Some men don't bow to bhikkhunis, and that's their prerogative. And you're right that the Gurudharmas are not, legally speaking, rules, but only recommendations. I like them. Red lights are just recommendations on the road. But here we can take the Gurudharmas. I think the matter of respect is very important. As Buddhism goes to the West, I wouldn't want us to relinquish respect among monastics altogether. I hope that respect will continue, because in our culture, as we know, civility is in decline in general in society, and we definitely in the monastic community want to help encourage civility and respect and so forth. Okay, so good, thank you for clarifying. Yeah. Well, good, in the Pali, the Gurudharmas are not part of the ordination procedure, but I'm glad to see that clarification. In fact, I'm so happy with all of the clarifications that have been made during this lecture series. I think it's really vitally important. I hope that the speakers and the listeners will follow up further research and will put their research into writing, so that we'll have more and more to work with. We'll be able to clarify some major misconceptions about what it means to be a nun, about what the precepts for the bhikkhunis are, what's required, what's expected, and that we can build stronger and stronger bhikkhuni communities. I hope you'll all be able to visit the monastery where I am right now and see how the accommodation, the sort of way that they have managed to keep the Vinaya very, very strictly and yet make certain accommodations for modern life and for Taiwanese culture and so forth. Very interesting to study and to meet with them and dialogue with them. So how many more minutes do we have? time for more questions. Any more questions? Well, I would like to encourage all of you who are ordained to please observe your precepts as carefully as possible. I hope that all of us will practice it in our own ways. Those of you who are considering ordination, I hope that this series has been helpful for you, so that you know what you're getting into and what your options are. I hope that those of you who are not ordained and do not plan on becoming ordained, I would like to thank you for your support. For those of us who are attempting to follow this ancient path and to make it available to more people in the present day as an alternative, a possible alternative to the crazy, insane lifestyle that we see in many cities today, and the problems that lifestyle brings. The monastics, by focusing their time and energy on the Buddhist teachings, we're doing our best to try to provide answers, counseling, and guidance to those who wish to follow in this ancient and wonderful tradition. I think that it has much to offer people, solutions for psychological problems, for the environment, for animal rights, in so many ways, the Buddhist teachings are so beneficial, so helpful, so useful, and so practical, and so relevant to people's lives today. So let us support each other in the various ways that we wish to practice. I think that we should be very careful not to criticize or condemn one another for our failings, which are, of course, I mean, speaking for myself alone, are many, but to the contrary, that we should try to encourage and support each other on this wonderful path to liberation. Thanks very much to Venerable Nalio and to his wonderful team who have made this opportunity possible. Well, we apologize for any shortcomings, and I personally like to apologize for shortcomings in my own talks and research, and hope to learn from all of you. Thank you very, very much. May you all be well. May you all be peaceful. May you all be happy. May we all proceed apace, step by step, toward liberation and awakening.